is a shorthand that the Earth's spectrum, the spectrum of Earth's heterogeneity, is red. And it has some important and positive consequences. Essentially, the practical consequence is that because the spectrum is red, we can actually discover things, fundamental things about the Earth, even though our coverage of the Earth interior, or sampling of the Earth interior, with current receivers and sources is incomplete and for certain purposes not adequate. The fact that the spectrum is red all tells you that in these long wavelengths there is a lot of power. Additional advantage is that the long wavelengths anomalies are much easier to resolve than short wavelengths anomalies. So you have a sort of double boost here, and this allows us to do things that were difficult to do some 350 years ago, although people tried. You can early model of the plume sources. Yeah, and the Earth core. And of course, in 350 years, we have progressed greatly. And we have now a collection of cartoons. This is especially from Edgar Nero's collection of files. but actually, we can do a little bit better. And I think that Alan, when he spoke on, showed that, some of the things can be actually modeled. One of the problems is that the seismic tomography, so of course, provided a great opportunity to look inside the Earth, but it also introduced a lot of confusion. So the very different things were coming out of people's computers, even though they used the same data set.
What is this
then? This is a cross-section through the Earth along a polar path. It's actually sort of not any cross-section, but this is the cross-section where you essentially have prevalence of high velocities, particularly if you look near core-mantle boundary. And this is the great circle that the virtual geomagnetic poles like to travel. So in some sense, you would like to see that this is blue. So this is a, it's a p velocity, and all these studies use ISC data. And what was different is that the number of parameters that was attempted to be resolved is quite different. This is degree 12 spherical harmonic. Degree 5 by 5, which roughly corresponds to the equator, which roughly corresponds to degree 36, I guess. And this would correspond to degree, I think, 90 or something like that. And even though this is supposed to have the largest resolution, as you can see, this is a very empty model. We used to show this as a slide to convince people that we need more seismographic stations in the southern hemisphere. However, if you look at these models, this one is much fuller, but if you look closely, you see actually the amplitudes in the northern hemisphere are higher than amplitudes in the southern hemisphere. There is no reason. It is also because we asked for a little bit more, we got a little bit less. That is, we got the indication that somehow southern hemisphere is weaker.
What kind of regularization is employed in these models? Probably different for each case, right?
For each case, yeah. And what Van der Heuvel did, he doesn't show places. It's sort of a bit misleading because he solved for many more cells. I think that this is 2 by 2 degrees horizontally, and I think about 100 kilometers radially. This is about 200 kilometers radially. So, well, here we essentially used smoothness. Here was norm and smoothness, and maybe this is why this southern hemisphere is weaker. And I think that van der Hughes also used some combination of the norm and smoothness. But so, in some sense, the perception and from tomographic work, and this is still not the worst of it. There seems to be a inverse correlation between our ability to mark, to distinguish features, and the number of parameters on a global scale, and the number of parameters that we're trying to obtain. This is actually a very early model. It's a different color scheme. But actually, here, this is equatorial section, cross section, and you see the African and Pacific superplume. Here you would have a hard time, even though this model has 1,000 parameters more than this model. And the other two models you have seen, and actually, you know, there's actually pretty good, you can see the Pacific superplume and African superplume. The African superplume, most of it is south of the equator. So,
it's interesting to look at this, the model with the 250,000 parameters, that doesn't look like the variations are, they seem to be long wavelength anyways when you get them out. And you probably have to increase the damping, right, and the regularization.
Yeah, but you know, yeah, I guess maybe you would.
There's like an interesting trade-off here or something.
Yeah. Well, he did use, but if you look here, I guess, there are some very short wavelengths solutions. So, in any case, this is not a very good model, even though it became, I mean, in terms of resolving global scale features, it doesn't take advantage of this redness of the spectrum and ask for a lot of parameters. But this particular model became very influential because this is what put into geochemists and others' mind that actually slabs go straight in. We'll come back to that. Generally, I think that reasonably carried out tomography is in a fairly good shape. This is four models at a 70-kilometer depth, so it's nearly at the top. And as you can see, they are very similar, even in some minor details here, like in the Pacific. All the cratons are resolved, mid-ocean ridges. I think we are getting really good. The mid-ocean ridges become quite well concentrated near the plate boundary. Our computer doesn't know that there is plate boundary, only when it plots the map. And we are also agreeing pretty well at the other end, at just above Kormantu boundary. And again, there are these four models. And there are some differences between them. I think that this model probably is overdumped. This shows more details than the others. But if you look at the details, for example, of the Pacific superplume, it's actually more like a group here. That they differ fairly significantly. But, I mean, there's no question that this is something that has very red spectrum. This is a little bit of an aside, but in the last several years, there has been confusion also introduced into community, and particularly petrologists believe in it, that there is a great difference, and there is a need to use finite frequency versus ray theory, and that you get much better models if you use finite frequency. Now, this is the case. This is Colleen Dalton, from Colleen Dalton's thesis. So she actually constructed a kernel, finite frequency kernel, for radio waves at a period of 35 seconds. and Rayleigh waves at a period of 200 seconds. And then, because we expand models in a relatively low degree harmonic, so this is up to degree 18. If you expand this in spherical harmonics and then synthesize it up to only degree 18 or reject, you get this. Now, the ray theory would be just a line, sort of a delta function as you cross the equator. But you can also expand it in spherical harmonics. Okay, and if you truncate it at degree 18, this is what you get. And you can see these two are identical. It's somewhat counterintuitive, but it's actually true. At 200 seconds, there's a little bit more difference, but it's not significant. So essentially, even though there can be other things wrong with models, but on a global scale, when the wavelengths are small in comparison to distance between source and receiver, the ray theory actually is not a problem. So if you are not going to believe some models because they use the ray theory, you have to use some other reasons. Actually, all the four models that I showed before rely to some extent on the ray theory, although there are some important details. Now we are coming to the...
Make models, say, back on your first or second slide, that were sort of on a 2-degree by 2-degree grid, right? Using finite frequency versus using ray theory, then it could start to make a difference.
It could start make a difference, yes.
Could, but so, it's still dominated by the problem of sampling rather than the actual basis.
Well, probably, you know, yes, because if you think about something like blocks 2 by 2 degrees, so the way that people do that is each block that was touched by a ray sort of enters into the solution. So if you make a bigger block, so you apply a low-pass filter, essentially.
Right.
And so then the your influence of your ray spreads in this way. So degree 18 is sort of pretty wide swath. But yes, taken to the limit, of course, ray theory would be very difficult because rays would never intersect because they have infinitely thin. Now, we took several sort of terrestrial functions and expanded spherical harmonics and showed their spectra. So this is ocean function, and what you see here is a piece of spectrum, the lowest degrees, that is very flat.
What do you mean by ocean function?
This is either continent ocean, one is one and the other one is zero.
Okay.
Or, you know, can be crustal thickness with continents having, say, 35 kilometer thickness, or an ocean's 10 or whatever. So this is how it looks like. You have a flat piece. This actually goes from degree 1 to 5. Then this particular one that has an offset. And then you have something that decreases steeply, that both axes are logarithmic. Free air gravity behaves similarly. Up to degree, this starts with 2, so 7. It's pretty flat. It has a little bit of a slope, but it's pretty flat. And then it goes down steeply. And the same is true with, for example, the SS residuals plotted as a function of the mid-path reflection point at the surface. And it depends a little bit how you fit these things. This is more attenuated, putting more weight on the smoothness. This is trying to fit it in such a way that the RMS of observations, the RMS error of observations would be satisfied. So you can see that this is a little bit less steep. Now these are two, this is an early 1990 model by a Japanese group, with Inoue being the first author. This is one of the upper mantle layers. So this does behave very well, but this part of the spectrum also goes down. Layer 16 is deep in the mantle. Maybe it's a last layer before core mantle boundary, I don't remember. And it has clearly this behavior, flat and then steep. So how does it work? What the implications are? So this is once again the spectrum of the power of the ocean function, and here we are building it using only first 8 spherical harmonics. And then we, since there's no mysteries here and we know as well as we want to, we expand that to degree 32. So this map is assembled with 15 times more coefficients. But if you need glasses and you don't happen to have them, it's actually, you can see that most of the information, the important information, is that mostly continents are grouped in fairly large size bodies is already enclosed here. Here, by using 15 times more coefficients, you actually find that there's Madagascar, that there are probably Japanese islands, some hint of New Zealand, but the basic information already is here.
It seems like the extra coefficients seem to go into sharpening up the boundaries.
Well, yes, they sharpen the boundaries, and as you can see, essentially contours of the continents are, you know, for example, here you really did India injustice, I guess, but here it's okay. But I repeat again that just looking at this picture, you could tell that the Earth, if it was core mantle boundary, you would actually say, well, you know, this seems to be something built of very large, uniform pieces of surfaces.
If we lived in the core, what would we think? Surface.
Yeah. The point is that we obviously cannot resolve things to degree 32 near core mantle boundary, but we can degree 8. So if you have a right kind of a spectrum, then you can actually recover the most important thing that is to be recovered. I apologize for lack of color here, but this is reproduction from paper, and we were too cheap to publish in color. So this is now the Fourier gravity. These are degrees from 2 to 8, and you see this big band of negative anomalies. You see the positive anomalies here, the new center, more or less, in New Guinea, Solomons. Here we throw in 4 times more coefficients, and you still see this basic structure. There are some other details, and here we increase it to degree 32, and you still can see the basic structure, actually even larger features. And if you use 1,500 times more coefficients than you did using this map, the principal thing is a different color scale, but the principal thing, which is the negative gravity anomalies around the Pacific, remain the same. So even by assembling gravity only to degree 8, you find the fundamental shape and fundamental features in a Earth gravity field. It would be even more convincing if I plotted geoid, because you dump then much more the high degree coefficients. Now, obviously, in a degree 8, you would not have resolved trenches. You don't actually see them to degree 32. But if you think in terms of the RMS values, the total power, there's extremely little power in these things. It's simply coefficients are in phase, so you get this large feature, but they are very narrow, so they don't really add very much to the power. So, well, we are not going to be going that high, and I don't think that in 96 we could resolve coefficients up to degree 360, but they tried. So how do you make a power spectrum like this? So this is a numerical experiment, very simple. We simulated by an ellipse which had the dimensions 40 by 60 degrees at the equator, Africa more or less in one case, and the other one in Australia. And we said that this is 1, the rest of it is 0, and the same here. And here you get 2 spectra. And here you have more power. And you get this flat spectrum, which has a corner at about degree 5. And after that, it actually begins to decrease. This is the exact fit on this logarithmic scale, but this is essentially L to minus 2. And this is the Australia. And you have the spectrum. The corner here is at degree 8 or so. And again, this steeply descending part is also pretty close to L to minus 2. So you get a spectrum like that of ocean function by essentially having a bunch of relatively large cohesive areas and of one type and then cohesive areas of the other type. So if you add a bunch of these for each continent, you go and get this flat part, then a corner someplace, and then the decrease like L to minus 2. So obviously it's a converging series, but as shown with both gravity and... So that's... there have been also confusion introduced in the past regarding expansion in spherical harmonics, or essentially truncation of the spectrum at some point. So this is experiment not made for this purpose. The idea was to obtain relatively high resolution tomographic, upper mantle tomographic map for Eurasia, but we did it in such a way that we derived a global model of relatively low resolution. It's more or less corresponding to degree 18. And then we increased by a factor 16. Essentially, the knots of the spherical splines were 1/4 of the distance that they were here. So we have 16 times more coefficients. And then we essentially corrected the observations, surface waves, waveforms, everything for the global model, and then for the path that intersected Eurasian continent, we inverted it again. So basically, you should obtain only, if things work, only short wavelength features. You can see that even though it is 16 times more coefficient, the amplitudes here are much less. If you add the two, then you get a high resolution map for Eurasia. And you can see that some things have changed. For example, here India and Tibet border sort of look like a blob. And here you get a very nice sharp change from positive velocity anomalies to negative velocity anomalies. Now you also see more detailed structure of the Eurasian cratons. So the point here is that obviously it's good to have more coefficients, but the basic map is not really, or the final map is not that different from the original one. So the main features are still there. This is another experiment that in these sort of inversions where we explain travel times, that if anything, we are overestimating power in higher degrees. So this is an example of fitting spherical harmonics to phase velocities of many thousands of observations of Rayleigh phase velocity at 75 seconds and 150 seconds. So that's a red line. The blue line is if, in addition to phase travel times, you include amplitudes. The amplitudes are depends on the second derivative of velocity. So they are much more sensitive to short wavelength structures. So in order to satisfy both phase and amplitudes, actually it turns out that the amplitudes tell us that there should be less amplitude at higher higher wave numbers. So I guess in this particular case, up to degree 10, they both give you the same answer. But at higher degrees, you eventually wind up with something like 3 times smaller amplitudes, and the difference is even more pronounced for the 150 seconds, which have a little bit worse signal noise ratio, mostly because the signal is less. So this is further confirmation that the spectrum is red. Now, this is the whole Earth. And here we have expansion in spherical harmonic of the structure from MOHO to the Kolmantu boundary. And this is the RMS value. The red line is the, actually it's published in 2000, it came out just in JGR, this paper, so it's 2008. This is the black is an older model. And you can see that actually the new model has better radio resolution. So it has the high amplitudes in the first 250 or so kilometers. Then it really nosedives, and then actually increases a little bit in a transition zone. Then it drops by nearly a factor of 2 and then increases again at the bottom of the mantle. So if you look at the spectra, you see this is red, although it decays more slowly, and the maximum power actually is in degree 5, and that has to do with cratons. They're actually well represented by degree 5. Then you actually have something different here. All of a sudden you have strong degree 2 above the 650 kilometer discontinuity. And then you go to the bottom of the mantle, you again have very large amplitudes, mostly in degree 2, to a lesser extent degree 3.
And what effect does the triplication have on a feature like that step, when you say the crossing over, and you're actually missing, like, they're passing over.
We are not using, I guess I didn't, it will come up. We don't use travel times, directly travel times, to model the transition zone. Mm-hmm. We use overtones of, which is like body waves, but it's use the whole waveform. So if there's a triplication, it's somehow built in the inversion process. So actually, yeah.
And you allow for decorrelation between the upper mantle and the lower
mantle? In this particular model, the expansion is such that it can be discontinuous. We did a number of experiments on this, and over the length of some 200 kilometers, 100 kilometers on each side of the boundary, obviously if you insist that the structure be continuous, it will be continuous. But then these two models, one discontinuous, the other one continuous, are identical. So to the extent that we can resolve things, the discontinuous model is probably preferred. But other models, and I'm going to show some more, like here, even though the expansion is continuous, they essentially show the same feature. So what you see here in these three models is they all have very similar spectrum near the surface. The case in some models a little bit faster than the others. All of them have this local maximum in a transition zone. And then all of them have this large signal at the Kolmantu boundary. But if you look carefully, and it's probably most visible in the Caltex model, this degree 2 continues throughout the whole lower mantle with lower amplitudes. And here is actually degree 2 and 3. It's also to some extent in a Berkeley model. So that's actually will be shown later, I guess, in sort of slightly different context. Now, this type of a spectrum where you have, well, actually the surface boundary layer is not expensive, but that you have a red spectrum in the transition zone and then a red spectrum at the bottom and a white spectra sort of in between was actually modeled reasonably well by Takri's 93, I guess, model, and then early 94. And here is sort of difficult to see. It's graphics actually taken from that paper. The lines here are bunching up, so in the upper mantle, which there are no plates or anything, so the surface is not particularly interesting. But here you have a large wavelength anomalies because the cold subducting material accumulates there. Here the spectrum is relatively white, and then the lines bunch up together, partly because as these avalanches come down, they splatter against the Kármán-Tú boundary and essentially introduce the large wavelength field. So, and you see the same thing in the seismic spectrum, other than here you also have surface boundary layer. So, about transition zone. So, this ability to resolve the structure in a transition zone, we're looking here in more detail, and it's actually more pronounced at the bottom of the transition zone than at the top, comes as a result of using a fairly complete data set that consists of surface waves, overtones, and then teleseismic travel times to sample the lower mantle. So I guess the next slide, if I'm not, oh, okay. So this was in spectra, and this is how it looks in space domain. You have these large, particularly in the Western Pacific, areas of high velocities. There's a little bit under South America too, but at 800 kilometers depth, this disappears. And here is the comparison of the spectra at 600 and 800 kilometers, very flat, small. And you can see this peak at degree two in all three models. So all these three models have the same properties and resolve the same structure. How it comes about? It's because some models are entirely based on travel times. This plots sensitivity rather than resolution, but they are related. So the travel time data have very good resolution in lower mantle, not that good resolution in the upper mantle. The scale changes between upper and lower mantle. The surface waves have very good resolution at the top, but then it decreases and essentially has no resolution in the lower mantle. So to support this middle, we actually use these waveform data, which can be also called overtone data. And if you add all three together, then you have a fairly uniform and good resolution at all levels in the mantle. So this middle subset of data is critical in the sense that this is what allows us to resolve the structure in a transition zone. All other models or research groups essentially don't use these data. Steve Grant is sort of a special case, but because he uses travel times, so in that sense, overtones, but he had difficult time in measuring travel times for multiple S-wave reflections when they bottomed in a transition zone. I guess he sort of improved it because his 2002 model is a little bit different. Okay, so this structure in a transition zone, well, it's sort of confirmed by regional studies and most of the slabs essentially terminate at about 600 in terms of the penetration, terminated 650 discontinuity. Some of them go a little bit deeper, but there is a question of how good this resolution is, and only two that, in quote marks, I guess, go into the to the Coromantum boundary is the Farallon and they call it Indian slab, I guess, and they're both inactive subduction zones. But so for most part, things the 650 boundary is in terms of the continuous slab images. Now, how does it look like in our models? Well, there are three cross sections, one through Japan, the other one through Izubonen, and last one is the meridional cross section. And as you can see, well, these are earthquakes actually. So this is very wide range. This is 20 degrees here, so this is about 3,000 kilometers. These things are about 4,000 kilometers in length, so there is an enormous amount of cold material. And the, another thing is that this black line shows actually the change in the topography of the 400 and 650 kilometer discontinuities. So they are under this blue stuff, they are depressed down. The vertical extent of the depression, the white stuff is the constant radius, 650, and I guess here it's 660. It's difficult to agree on the nomenclature, but it's actually 650 is probably a better estimate of the average. So this is exaggerated by a factor of 4, but you can see that in all cases, the 650 boundary is depressed. Not much topography on the 400. The other evidence that there is something happening at 650 is essentially from earthquakes. Just the earthquake distribution. This is Chile, Bolivia. And here you have a nice bunch of deep earthquakes with a very similar mechanism. But then you step and some 250 kilometers you have an earthquake, sort of big earthquake, there's no question that it's here, with essentially the p-axis having 90 degree different depth. So two things happened. Somehow the slab got farther inland than it should be if it went straight through the mantle, into the lower mantle. And two, that somehow the stress pattern has changed. Much busier place is the Tonga Kermadec, and you have a lot of earthquakes there. And what happens there is the cross section is through this red box. That as you cross 500 kilometers of around 550 or so, the both the seismicity goes flatter and the P axis change completely their orientation. Now to make things more complicated, there is one earthquake, pretty big one, isolated by about 100 kilometers, both horizontally and vertically, which is right at the 700. So it's the largest deep earthquake that we know about. And that essentially follows the dip of the zone. But it's clear that in terms to the extent that earthquake have something to do with slabs, that the slab here gets deformed and that the stress distribution is entirely different.
Is it necessarily the stress, though, that's changing? It could also be the rheology that's changing there, and the stress is just being rotated by a rheological complexity.
It could be. I guess we so far don't really know what causes deep earthquakes, but it's clearly different. They are fairly, well, there's one across, but they are fairly uniform along the whole depth, and this change occurs. And it's pretty much the same whenever you make a cross section. I didn't want to make them too. So this picture, which engraved itself in the minds of great many earth scientists, which used to be shown, and actually some geochemist study that talks with showing this picture and saying, well, it's been demonstrated that stuff straight goes straight through the mantle, and therefore, you know, whatever I say next is relevant and true. Actually, even this picture can be put in doubt a little bit. There are models like the ones that I've been showing you. Well, this actually includes even Grant's model. The velocity scale, the bar, color bar, is a little bit different. I don't show it for this. They essentially have a very large scale where things are just yellow. And so but what happens, all of them see what's called Farallon slab, but they also see other things. And you can see actually even in this scale, this is showing, but if you go to this picture, it's actually showing throughout the lower mantle. So these are some velocity anomalies that don't have anything to do with recent subduction. So it's not really clear whether this is really a Farallon plate or is it some very large scale structure in a lower mantle. I don't show it, but a very similar picture is obtained if you make a cross section through the Western Pacific.
There's actually a big geoid anomaly there.
Yeah, and it's sort of double there in that part here. But well, there's one negative velocity anomaly here and there's another one here.
Right.
Because this cross section starts at this more or less in Hawaii someplace, and so this all this is under Pacific. There's nothing that happened there, and all six models show this. On the other hand, if you look at these two models that affected so much the community, and look their transition zone, there's nothing. So if somebody relies on those models and say, well, you know, I don't see any signal in transition zone. Grant, since then, his 2002 model begins to have some anomalies both under South America and Western Pacific. But they are still relatively low amplitude compared with the other models. So, as I say, it's difficult to resolve well transition zone with the type of data that and measurements that Grant uses, which, you know, is this all these very complicated caustics. Yeah.
Why is there so much white in the lower model?
Well, this is van der Heuvel's model, and essentially he uses teleseismic travel times. And a depth of 550 kilometers, he essentially, well, you have to be halfway, which, you know, it's essentially nearly the same point because on this scale. So his coverage with station and earthquake is very poor there. So essentially his whole Pacific is blank.
That wouldn't be true for the Grant
model? No, because he uses multiple reflections. So you still have SS waves that are reflected at midpoints under oceans, triple S.
When you're dealing with travel times, right, the travel time branches around the triplication cross over, and if you're measuring first arrival times, you're only getting part of those branches. You're not, people aren't measuring the second ones. And so there's a whole swath of information that's being missed there that's not being included.
That's true, and this is why people use mostly teleseismic travel times to avoid these enormous complications and nonlinearities associated with this structure. But that, you know, this is a problem for several models. For example, Princeton model, you know, gave you exact maps of the upper mantle with plumes coming all the way to the surface, but essentially they used teleseismic travel times and they had very low, if any, resolution in the upper mantle. Now, things are not that simple. This boundary at 650 need not be absolute. So there are strong but spatially limited fast anomalies in the lower mantle under the blue areas in a transition zone, and they may represent regions of limited penetration of subducted material accumulated in a transition zone. zone, I guess, should be not zones. So the conclusion is that the Overton waveform data are critical for resolution of the transition zone structure. So the fact that some models using teleseismic travel times don't have structure in a transition zone doesn't mean that it's not there. The change in the spectrum across the system is as sharp as can be resolved at the present time. So that it indeed is, there is a distinct difference between transition zone and a lower mantle below it. And from this we conclude that it's a boundary layer that could be penetrated by episodic events, but it does not permit a steady state circulation across the 650 kilometer discontinuity. So now we go to lower mantle. And aside for the lower mantle is people tend to make measurements in selected places. So there was a paper published on the scale of variations in lower mantle based on SCS minus S travel time anomalies measured within these areas. Within the ellipses, and they wrote a paper and they said what it is. But if you look at the whole world, they actually picked one type of structure, the fast anomalies. This is SCS travel time, so minus means that it's at a faster path. But if you use global measurements, which are shown by these triangles. So you have a whole bunch of down-pointing triangles, for example, here in the Pacific, you have some holes. But then if you fit spherical harmonics into it, you can see this very dominant degree 2, mostly 2-2, structure in the lower mantle. So this is in the data. This doesn't come from computer. Well, it came from computer, but no extensive processing. So this is just the data. And so by focusing on the selected points at the core mantle boundary, you essentially miss the elephant, which is this very big structure. So these local studies, you have to be careful in trying to generalize them. So the mega plumes are these big structures which some call thermochemical piles, but there's one more letter, I guess.
D-T-C.
Okay, so here I compare two models, one from Scripps, one from Caltech, and this is view from above. So this is about 800 kilometers. I cut off the upper mantle because it would sort of obscure the rest of the picture. You can see that actually these structures go throughout the lower mantle. The blue, this is minus 6 isosurface, this is plus 6% isosurface. So here you also see this big circle of fast velocities around the Pacific. And here you look from the below the core mantle boundary. No, 0.6. So they are pretty continuous structures, better defined actually than the fast anomalies. Fast anomalies are more subdued, so it's not really clear whether the main structure is this, because the average is removed, and that the blue is essentially neutral. But on the maps, it's blue because we want to have zero average. You can see the same thing in a different way look at the Grant's model, again from Garnero's website. And so he plotted everything, I guess. But as you can see, there are the two columns, red and blue, which again shows this persistent pattern throughout the lower mantle of the degree 2 anomalies. The important thing that the Caltech group and then Berkeley have done is to show essentially that there are sharp boundaries to these superplumes. And this is sort of view of the African superplume from different directions. But what's wrong with this picture is that they essentially have a top of the superplume at only 300 kilometers.
They just stopped plotting it. That's why they put the question mark on the top.
Yeah, but they show here. They show here actually some arrows which seem to flow down. So I'm not really quite sure.
No, that was just the way they plotted.
But the statement here is not from their paper. Oh, you have what?
There's another talk in 1 minute.
Oh. Okay, I have to go very fast then. I'm actually not too much left. You can see the extent of the, well, in this case mostly Pacific, but also African superplume, 500 kilometers above the mantle in just travel time. So this doesn't involve any inversion. This is just averaging travel times. The lower mantle radio correlation function is the way to compare velocity distributions at two different depths, so it's always one on the diagonal because you're comparing map with itself. But this is, for example, this point here compares velocities at the depth of 2500 kilometers with velocities at 1500, and then the color bar, the dark red, is one, which is what you see on diagonal. What it tells us essentially is that the whole lower mantle is to some extent correlated with itself, and actually slightly negatively correlated with the upper mantle. So again, indication that upper and lower mantle are somewhat different. This has to do with the resolution of the shear and bulk velocities. At 550 kilometers, they are positively correlated. At 2800, they are negatively correlated. And this correlation changes as a function of depth, positive in the upper mantle, then slowly decreasing to minus 0.8 in the last 1,000 kilometers. It doesn't depend very much on which degrees you use. The 1 to 3 are better resolved, so they actually have somewhat higher negative correlations, even less than minus 0.8. And so I will skip this. It's sort of pretty much speculative, but the state of deep earth science is not very satisfactory at this time, and this is a role of CIDR trying to help this. This is a comparison. This is actually cover from a book, and this is a picture taken from paper by Kurt Yeol, and this is picture that Don Anderson drew. And essentially they both, it's fairly recent, both are fairly recent, and they both have the same information, but they arrived at totally different pictures. So what actually CIDR should do and can do, I think, is to establish a new way of putting things together, which requires more understanding and somehow integration of knowledge, which at the present time is not quite embedded in the way we educate people. So thank you very much.